I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. President Bush has been having some trouble recently selling his ideas for changing Social Security. Late last week, in a nationwide news conference, the president said he has a different proposal.
I propose a Social Security system in the future where benefits for low-income workers will grow faster than benefits for people who are better off. By providing more generous benefits for low-income retirees, we'll make this commitment. If you work hard and pay into Social Security your entire life, you will not retire into poverty.
Now, the fine print says that these more generous benefits for low-income retirees are subsidized with benefits from the higher-income retirees. And still, the president says people who want to would be allowed to divert money into private accounts. This hour, we're going to talk with Bob Posen. He is the man who devised this new plan, this form of progressive indexing for Social Security. We'll hear from a critic, but we'd also like to hear from you. What do you think? Do you like this new idea for changing Social Security? What about the idea of using benefits from wealthier workers to help out those who earn less? Is that fairness at its best? Or does it break the promise of Social Security as a program that helps everyone equally? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're starting today with the man who put together this form of Social Security change. His name is Robert Posen. He's currently chairman of MFS Investment Management, a former senior executive with Fidelity Investments. He served on the president on President Bush's Commission on Social Security. Welcome to The Connection.
Thank you, Dick. Appreciate it.
Can I call you Bob for
sure,
the program?
Sure, absolutely.
All right. I want to begin, if I can, Bob, by setting aside the private personal account part of this debate. I know it's essential to the way people feel about change for Social Security, but I think it may be one way of kind of zeroing in on the kind of change that you're proposing by looking at how the benefits are moved.
I agree totally with that, Dick, and I want to make clear that when I published progressive indexing first in the New York Times, it didn't have any personal accounts. It stands alone as an approach to solvency, and I've been trying to say over and over again, and I'm glad you're going this direction. First, we need to address solvency. What is our approach to solvency? Then we can decide whether we're going to have any personal accounts of any sort.
Okay, let's talk about it in two ways then. First, what is the kind of change that you're proposing and how does it work? On the what is side, people are looking at this and saying it is a transformation of Social Security from a sort of government run retirement fund to a different, to a kind of welfare where there is more money being moved from wealthier people to people who have less. Is that an accurate reflection of it?
I do not agree with that. In fact, I would disagree strongly, but I think it takes a little bit of explaining to get there. First, let's be clear about what we mean by progressive indexing. Right now, most people think that Social Security is price indexed because they think of the cost of living adjustments that apply after you are in retirement. Your monthly checks go up if the consumer price index goes up. But at the time of the calculation of your initial benefits, Social Security gives you your average career earnings per year, and then they increase that, not by the amount that prices have gone up during your working career, but by the amount that wages have gone up over your working
career. Can I stop you there? The two things, a wage index or a price index. What's the big difference between the two of them?
It may seem like a technical distinction, but wages go up roughly a little over 1% more than prices per year. Wages have to do with what people are making in the economy, and prices obviously do with the market basket of goods and services. And because there is this 1% difference over a 35-year period, it makes a big difference. And the question that we have to ask ourselves is, you know, can we afford, in a system that has a deficit of close to $4 trillion, can we afford this more generous indexing, wage indexing versus price indexing? The beauty of price indexing is we're protecting the purchasing power of Social Security benefits for all workers. And so my scheme is pretty simple. For low-wage workers, and that means $25,000 or less, in earnings, and people in Boston and in other parts of, let's say, the West Coast would be surprised to know that that constitutes 30% of all workers.
People making less than $25,000
in average career earnings.
Right.
So it's a big chunk of the working group. We would continue to wage index them. They continue to preserve exactly the same benefits they would have now, and we would also not change in any way the formulas for people who would retire before 2012 so that we would protect not only people who are in retirement, but people who are close to retirement. But then the high-wage worker, and we define the high-wage worker as $113,000 and above. We say that that high-wage worker would get his or her initial benefits indexed to prices, not to wages. And then in between, there's a complex formula that would have a mix.
It's like two lines crossing on a graph, if you will, from prices at one side to wage index at the other.
Right.
But it means that over time, and I have to try and simplify this to understand it for myself. It means that over time, the people who earn the most money in America don't get the same amount of benefits from Social Security that they would expect to get under the system as it exists today.
Under the schedule. Under the schedule, they're going to get less than the benefits under the schedule. The problem is we have a schedule that's close to $4 trillion in the hole. So someone is going to have to get less than the schedule. One of my main points is it's not very useful to talk about benefit cuts relative to the schedule because we can't possibly afford it. And one way to look at it is if we don't have major Social Security reform, the system goes into default around 2041, and we have, by 2045, about a 27% cut in benefits. That's automatic. So the question isn't whether someone's going to get less than scheduled benefits. The question is, how much are people going to get relative to what we can afford? And that's a very different question. Now, the point you raise is, yes, high-wage workers will get slower-growing benefits than they would under the schedule. They still would be growing. For workers below $113,000, they would be growing in purchasing power terms as well as nominal terms.
And the amount they contribute remains the same. It doesn't go down.
Correct. So they would be getting less than they would under the schedule, and low-wage workers would be getting the same. Now, in 2079, which is when we tend to measure all these things, where that's the end of the 75-year solvency, there still would be a 20% difference between the high-wage workers and the low-wage workers in terms of benefits. So people who claim that this is going to get to a flat benefit are right if you run it through infinity. But my system ends in 2079. And if you think there needs to be more differential between high and wage low-wage workers, I've said, well, good, we can freeze progressive indexing at 2060. We can freeze it at 2050.
I have a really hard time with 2050, 2060, 2075. I do, because who knows what's going to happen politically between now and then? Who knows all the other factors that are going to affect this? One of the features of the proposal that I was trying to make sense of is what people will see in 2 years and in 5 years and in 10 years, because part of what you're proposing, and I should stress that it's a proposal from you, it's something the president is looking seriously at, and that's about the state of it right now.
Right.
It hasn't gone beyond that.
Right.
But what kind of changes will people see in that normal 5 to 10 years that people think?
Well, I think the answer is up to 2012, they'll see no changes. And then if you look at years like 2025, something like the middle earner will see a reduction from the schedule of about 6%. And if you look at 2045, it's about 16%. So these are actually quite modest decreases relative to the schedule. Now, the question is, if you look at it in terms of real purchasing power, if you look at what's the purchasing power of those monthly benefits, say, in 2045, they are substantially higher than they are today for the same worker. So purchasing power is growing up because we are growing these benefits. Remember, the middle wage worker will be growing at a blend of wage and price indexing, so they will be growing. And if we look at it in terms of any other criteria, such as what we can afford to pay, they'll be going up. Now, the question I do want to get back to is this differential between the high and the wage low-wage worker, which is brought about to a more significant degree by progressive indexing, is this justified? Is this a reasonable differential? There still would be a differential, as I said, 20%, but it'd be less than under the current schedule. And I think it is justified for two reasons. If you just look at Social Security alone, people think of the system as very progressive. And they think of it progressive because if a low-wage worker puts in $100, let's say he or she gets back $110. But if a high-wage worker puts in $100, on a monthly basis, they would get something like $106 back. That's just a hypothetical, just a simple illustration.
That's right now. That's before any changes.
Yeah, and correct. That's now. But what's interesting is that the high-wage worker lives 2 to 3 years more than the low-wage worker. So under the current system, the system is actually neutral. If we look at what the total benefits that are paid to the high-wage worker on average relative to their contribution, it's roughly the same on a lifetime basis as what the low-wage worker gets.
Although people are saying that once the middle class starts to look through this and say, well, I might not be getting as much under Bob Posen's plan as I was under the existing plan, that political support at that level will fall off. Are you concerned about that?
Well, I think you always have to be concerned about political support. But what I'm trying to point out is that the present system is not progressive. Even looking at Social Security, the present system is neutral. And I would predict over time that the differential between high and wage workers in terms of their longevity will increase. So
I need to stop you because we're going to have to take a short break. A reminder to our listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Bob Posen is my guest. We're talking about his proposals for changing Social Security, something that President Bush has now made part of the package that he's presenting to the country. 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to know your thoughts. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection this hour. We're talking about all the different ideas in the wind for changes to Social Security, specifically on the program today with Bob Posen on his proposal for progressive indexing, something that has been looked at quite carefully and chewed over the weekend since the president talked about it first in a news conference on Thursday evening. We're going to be joined now by Jason Furman. Jason is a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington. He was an economic advisor for President Clinton, most recently directed economic policy for the Kerry campaigns, joining us from New York. Hello, Jason.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, listen, all these ideas of redistributing wealth from the wealthy people to those who need it the most, the idea of making a system that's more fair, this sounds more like something from that you would be talking about, that the Democrats would embrace. What do you think?
Well, first of all, let me compliment Bob Posen. I think he's being very constructive in focusing on solvency rather than the accounts. That's the challenge that we're facing. And I think he's onto something when he says Social Security is not nearly as progressive as people think. When you do the numbers, it's still progressive, even after taking into account life expectancy, just not enough as much as a lot of people think. His plan, however, I don't think makes it a whole lot more progressive. And the reason is that it takes someone who makes $50,000, $60,000 a year and reduces their benefits by virtually the same amount that it reduces Dick Cheney's benefits. I don't think
you mean in
anything.
Percentage terms. You don't mean in cash terms. Is that right?
In percentage terms. Well, remember, Dick Cheney's benefits are only a tiny bit higher than somebody who's making $60,000 a year because you max out. I don't think that's the progressive way to go about Social Security reform. What I'd rather see is more of an emphasis on bringing new resources into the system so we can strengthen the retirement system.
What do you mean by new resources?
And do it progressively. I'll tell you four ways in which we could do that. Number one is right now you don't pay any payroll taxes above $90,000 a year. Due to increased inequality, that's actually hurt Social Security solvency. It's something not a lot of people realize because more money is earned above $90,000 a year and it doesn't go taxed.
So payroll taxes would go, we'd remove the cap, people would
Not remove it entirely. I'd move it up, maybe to something like $140,000 a year, maybe do that gradually. So that's one step. Another step would be some modest legacy charge above that, something like 3% a year above the tax.
You're saying a 3% tax on wages made above that, right? Like a wealth tax?
Exactly. To ensure that this would be something that would say someone like Dick Cheney is making a lot more money, so they should contribute more to restoring solvency, something they don't in in the Posen plan. A third step we could do is take the estate tax. I mean, the fundamental problem we're trying to solve is our long-term fiscal problem. You have the president on the one hand saying, let's repeal the estate tax, which costs an enormous amount of money, and then on the other hand saying, let's reduce benefits for middle-class families, people making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year.
Jason, I wonder if I can just sort of cut to principle here, because basically what you're saying, if I understand it, is that there are ways of improving Social Security, but your proposals are for raising taxes as a way of doing that rather than even looking at the benefit structure. Is that a reasonable characterization of that?
Oh, that's a reasonable characterization. I think benefits have a part to play in restoring solvency as well. I just would not cut benefits for middle-class families.
I mean, because one of the interesting things about this whole debate is that the president seems to have set certain conditions. The president, if I'm not mistaken, and Bob Posen, help me here, has said we've got to do this without raising taxes. Is that a condition?
I think the president has carefully hedged his bet on that. He said he's not willing to raise the rate. So our current rate is 12.4%. He has left open the question of whether he would raise the base above 90,000.
Okay, all right.
Now, the thing, Jason is correct. We could raise 90,000 to 140,000, but by my calculations, that would roughly close 30%, maybe a little less, of the deficit. So what we have to realize is that in order to have this payroll tax approach and really get anywhere close to solvency, we would have to have a huge increase in the payroll.
Oh, I wasn't suggesting that as the only part.
Well,
of the plan.
But let's think about raising the tax from 90 to 140,000, the base from 90 to 140,000. Think about the many people in Boston, New York, Washington, West Coast who are making 150,000. So now for them, between 90 and 140,000, they would start paying a 12.4% tax rate. That means that they're going to have really facing one of the largest tax increases of their life. And by contrast, somebody who was a millionaire, most of their earnings would not be taxed. And you do all this and you only have closed 30% of the deficit. So I think we have to get realistic that these sorts of payroll taxes would be very difficult to increase politically. And I hear Jason saying not only is he going to raise the base to 140,000, then he's going to have a legacy surtax on top of that. These are big tax increases, and I don't know whether they would fly politically. And second of all, they actually don't close the deficit. You would still need significant changes in the benefit structure.
All right, Connection listener, we'd like to hear from you. 1-800-423-8255. Lots of ideas here on the table for ways of changing Social Security. To Judy in Acton, Massachusetts. And Judy, what are you thinking?
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. The thing that seems to be missing to me from this plan is the middle class who are middle-aged, who don't have time to build up much of a private account, and also don't have pensions because companies have gotten rid of those, and then their benefits are going to be cut. And we know a lot of them aren't putting much into their 401k accounts. So it seems like people like myself are going to be squeezed. And I have a hard time feeling comfortable with the fact that Bill Gates pays his Social Security tax probably the first week of the year, and the rest of us are paying it all year long.
By middle class, Judy, you would put yourself above the $20,000-$25,000 earning, but below the sort of high income. Is that right?
Yes.
Well, I think if we look at, say, an earner in 2012 who was making $45,000, I'm just trying to say if you're 45 now, then in 2025 you'll be 65, you'll be retiring. Under that sort of system, the median earner would lose about 6% off the schedule. In 2025, we're talking about losing 6% off the schedule. So it's not a huge...
Just to stop here so I'm clear along with Judy. When you say 6% off the schedule, do you mean that each one of the checks that she would receive after retirement would be 6% less than
that
shows on her...
On the schedule now.
Okay.
Right. And I think that... And if we could forego it, we would. The person who is making $100,000 or $150,000 would have a much greater reduction. So this is what's known as progressive, that it's modest for the median worker and it goes up higher.
But we don't feel sorry for who's ever making $150,000 because that person's likely got their 401ks and their IRAs.
Well, the people in the median workers, we look and we see that if I look at medium income workers, about 50 to 75%, it depends, have 401ks and IRAs. But I think that everyone, this is one good point about the debate in Washington, Republicans and Democrats all agree that as part of this package, we ought to enhance incentives for people like Judy to put money into 401ks and IRAs. We already do have various tax benefits that are associated, but we can have better education, we can have a better checkoff, we can have various types of tax credits. There are a whole series of things we can do.
Judy, where would you be with that 6% cut?
You know, I think I don't necessarily personally have as much of an issue with it because I've been saving. But at the same time, I've got two girls who are going to be college age when my husband approaches retirement age. And, you know, it just, I think the reality of my generation that put off child rearing, had parents who live longer, and have had pension benefits disappear, this plan doesn't work for us.
Judy, just one more question on this, though. When you think about Social Security as something that your daughters will want to take advantage of when they enter the workforce, are you willing to concede to either Bob or Jason here that something needs to be done to improve the plan?
Yes. And to me, I think the cap is the issue. Right now, come late fall, we get a little bit of a raise, you know? And I would forgo that so that the plan would have more benefits.
Jason, you know? Furman, excuse me, how do you think that this is going to play out politically? I mean, we're talking about what people want, what people will tolerate. What are you thinking as you listen to Judy?
Right, well, first of all, I think people have to realize this plan is a lot less progressive. Bob was giving some numbers. Let me just, without trying to bore your listeners, for somebody making $60,000 a year, it's a 10% reduction in your benefits. For somebody making $6 million a year, it's an 11% reduction in your benefits. Is that progressive? Slightly, but a lot less so than was marketed.
Is it a question of numbers? If Bob Posen was to say not 25,000, make it 40,000. That's where the red line will cross the graph, and everybody below that can expect benefits as they're in the schedule right now. Is that all you're saying, though, Jason?
Well, there's two issues. One is whether this is the right magnitude of benefit reductions, and I think it's far too much. We're in effect having benefit reductions in Social Security so we can help fill a small part of the hole created by the president's tax cuts, which disproportionately benefited the most fortunate. There's a second issue, though, which is the whole economic rationale for the proposal is flawed. Right now in Social Security, payroll taxes grow with wages. Benefits should grow with wages also. That's the way a pay-as-you-go system would work in equilibrium. Now, they're not growing together, so there's something we need to do to make sure they are growing together. If you look at this
proposal... But doesn't
proposal,
that just end up taking more money out of the system?
No. To keep a pay-as-you-go system working, you want all sides of it growing at the same rate. Right now, the revenue side grows with wages. The benefit side, also in equilibrium, should grow with wages. Now, we have a demographic issue we need to address, but we don't have a wages grow too quickly issue that we need to address. And to give you an example of why this diagnosis and understanding the problem leads you in a different direction, under Bob's plan, if wages end up growing a lot more quickly than what we're expecting today, then his plan would end up cutting benefits even more than it would otherwise cut them. Now, that is at the very same time that Social Security is more solvent as a result of that faster wage growth. That's just perverse. The same thing works in reverse. If wage growth is a lot slower than what we're expecting today, then Social Security's problems are even bigger, and his plan would cut benefits even less.
All right, I want to take a look, if we can, at the other side. A reminder to our listeners, I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection.
I think that the issue of wage growth and its relationship to price growth is a technical issue that Jason has raised, and I've actually, in the Senate Finance testimony, described a way in which we could solve that by pegging the differential of indexing in a technical way, but I don't want to bore that. I think the most important issue is that wage indexing costs a lot in the context of the demographic issues we have. And when Social Security was enacted, there were no IRAs, there were no 401ks, there weren't all these other benefit plans. So when we look at this notion of a replacement ratio, we look at wage indexing as trying to help people maintain a reasonable percentage of retirement benefits relative to their pre-retirement income. Now, we can't hope to do that only from Social Security. For people at low wages, $25,000 and below, they really don't have IRAs and 401ks, and we need to look to make sure that Social Security preserves their replacement ratio. But for somebody, whether it's $50,000 or $60,000 or $70,000, we have to encourage and actually we have to ask these people to participate in these various programs, which are heavily tax subsidized. In 2004 alone, the federal government subsidized IRAs and 401ks to the tune of $55 billion. So we're already helping the middle and higher earners through these tax subsidies, and we need to take that into account when we think about what are you going to be your sources of retirement income after you retire.
Let's take a call from Raleigh, North Carolina. Brent's on the line. Hi, Brent. Tell me what you're thinking.
Dick, thanks for taking my call. Mostly just it seems really hard for me to understand how a person, I mean, between my girlfriend and myself, we're making about 60. How a person who's making $100,000 a year can't afford to put it away and not even need Social Security. I mean, that's $40,000 a year extra that, I mean, we're living comfortably. $40,000 a year for however many years that person's working, that they could be putting that away.
Are you saying, Brent, that people who make over $90,000 should be cut off completely from Social Security benefits?
I mean, this program is, you know, coming up on 60 years old, and, I mean,
here's the question, Brent. Here's where it gets interesting, because if you tell all the people who are making more than $90,000, you're not going to get any benefits from this program, then you've lost all their political support for the continuance of the program. And that's what gets people shaky. Once you start sort of to break it up that way, then you lose the political constituency that
it's called the Social Security, not political security. I mean, there's a point that the American public needs to just look at the people who are under them and realize that they need a helping hand. I mean, you know.
Right. I mean, there's one, if I could say something
about
that approach. I mean, there's one limitation to that. There aren't a whole lot of people making $100,000 a year, $150,000 a year. Even if you took all of them and eliminated their Social Security benefits entirely, you would solve, I don't know, 5-10% of the Social Security problem at the very most.
One of the reasons why I asked him that, Jason, was that the criticism that I've heard is that once you take one chop at the tree, doesn't matter if it's even a very small part, then people begin to sort of see the beginning of the end. And I mean, that's a criticism I've heard from Democrats over the past couple of days.
I think that criticism is very severe if you make the system more progressive and then combine it with individual accounts, especially of the size that the president has proposed, 4% accounts. If you look at the president's plan, your benefits would be reduced relative to the current schedule twice. Once, due to this progressive price indexing we've been talked about, and a second time to pay back the contributions that you made to your individual account.
I thought we were going to stay off personal accounts in this discussion, and I think that the point that's being made here is very important to be discussed politically, because the caller is saying, why don't we have zero benefits for people over $90,000 or $100,000? What I would agree with what Dick's suggestion is, then we are going to lose political support for the system, and I agree with Jason that we're not going to achieve much in the way of benefits. I think this is a social insurance scheme in which there has to be some relationship between what you pay in and what you pay out. What I've tried to do is basically say, to feather it, to basically say, as you get higher up the wage scale, there'll be a little less coming out of benefits relative to what you put in. And this is not means testing. It's what I call means tilting. And I think means tilting preserves this political support for the system and has a very positive effect on solvency.
1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, do you like this new idea for changing Social Security? Would it work for you? Would it work for your children? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. This hour, we're talking about the idea of progressive indexing in Social Security, something that would secure benefits for those making $25,000 and less, and something that would take some of the benefits of the higher income earners and use that to balance out those at the bottom. 1-800-423-8255. It's an idea proposed by Bob Posen, who's chairman of MFS Investment Management here in Boston. He sat on President Bush's Commission to Strengthen Social Security, 2001-2002. Jason Furman is also with us. He worked on economic policy in the Clinton administration, is currently a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, specializing in Social Security issues. We're going to go straight to a call in Charlotte, Vermont, and Anami is with us. Hi, Anami.
Good morning.
Tell me what you think.
I have absolutely no faith in anything that comes from this government regarding reordering society. These have been all conservative interests to get rid of Social Security, to make a flat tax, to regulate business. All these things are part of a larger plan to move society back to like 100 years ago.
So no matter really what is proposed by President Bush, you're going to be suspicious of it.
Yes, because what they're doing is if they cannot get it one way, they are going to chop away at another way. It is just a little nick in it. So they have been very, Grover Norquist, that whole group, they have been very skillful and good in chipping away at our social underpinnings.
Let me, turn this to Jason Furman here. Jason, I'm interested as you look at Bob Posen's plan and how the conversation changed last week. Is Anami perhaps representing a large group of Democrats, people who say, you know what, I don't care what they propose, I'm not going to be a part of a deal with this White House?
Right. Well, Dick, unlike you, I didn't actually hear anything change last week. The president started out years ago with a set of principles, and the principles were to restore solvency entirely through benefit reductions, to have individual accounts carved out of payroll taxes, and necessarily one implication of the two of those, to have large increases in debt over the coming decades, hoping that eventually the other two would kick in and repay it. That has been an approach that has, to say the least, the more he talks about it, the less people like it. And I think they don't like it on the benefit side, and I don't think they like it on the account side either.
See, what I
Thursday
heard
night
last...
was Thursday night was a tremendous opportunity to come out and say, there was something wrong with my premise. I've gone out. I'm glad that people understand that there's more of a problem than they used to, that I've gotten their attention. But I'm going to focus on solvency rather than accounts. And I'm going to do it in a more balanced way rather than doing almost the entire thing through reductions in benefits for middle class families.
What I heard on Thursday night was a level of detail that we had not heard from this president.
Wait a second, let me finish.
And the other thing that it seemed that he did was he put enough detail on the table for smart economic thinkers on the Democrat side to say, we can work with this or we can't work with this. We can shift it in this direction. This is the basis for some kind of a bipartisan agreement or not. And I'm just not entirely sure, Jason, if the whole thing has been shoved to one side out of the realm of negotiation, or if we're in the early stages of here's what I think that might lead to something.
Well, I'd say for Democrats in Congress, I think the thing that was most disappointing was the president's continued insistence on carve-out accounts. If it were just Bob Posen and I'll bet we could sit down and work something out. But I was trying to explain before, when you take this plan and you add accounts to it, it becomes a radically different plan,
which eliminates
Social Security for a large fraction of Americans. They would get their entire benefit from the account, and leaves the most vulnerable Americans even more dependent on Social Security. Yeah. So that
Jason,
type of dynamic is one that makes it hard to get something done.
Again, Jason, we're trying to stay away from personal accounts, and as you know, progressive indexing can stand without it. And
I know that's why I said we could work this out.
But that's what I'm trying to get at, Jason. Give me what's frustrating to me is okay. Let's put personal accounts off the table. So where do we see the proposal from people like you who are thoughtful thinkers, very expert on the situation? So what sort of package are you coming up with? If you take progressive indexing, you want to modify it somewhat, but if you want to have, as you seem to want to have, no change in scheduled benefits for the middle class. Well, then what are you suggesting?
I said much more moderate.
Okay, well, what are you suggesting specifically? What's the package that you feel?
Well, hang on
would
a second. Jason went through the raising the cap and the wealth tax and a couple of other things, and maybe it makes more sense to.
Is that the proposal?
What kind of pressure is on
the
Democratic Party to say, here's our plan, fully formed, here's our plan, and then you get to choose? What do you think, Jason?
I mean, I can come out with my plans, and there are plans out there. My friends, Peter Diamond at MIT and Peter Orszag at the Brookings Institution has one. Former Social Security Commissioner, worked for both Democrats and Republicans. Bob Ball had one. Those are both good plans. I have my own tweaks that I would do to them, and I'm not going to bore your listeners with that. The point
but
is
the
that's
party hasn't
not,
said, we like this idea. This is what we want to stand behind. Do you think
that's
that has
right,
to come?
Because I think the party doesn't want to stand up and stick their necks out with a plan when the president, by the way, still has not formally committed himself to a detailed plan mm-hmm. to restore solvency and hasn't taken the accounts off the table. I think once there's two, and it's almost to the president's credit that there's two completely different issues here. One is how to restore solvency. And one is whether or not you like accounts. Those issues are logically unrelated. The solvency one is much, much more important. If we just focused on that, I think we could get it done. But there's this huge elephant in the room keeping us from having this conversation.
1-800-423-8255 to Columbia, South Carolina. John's with us. Hey, John.
Hey, good morning. How are y'all?
I'm fine. Tell me what your thoughts are.
Well, first of all, I'm one of those guys that make over $500,000 a year that some of your listeners don't think that I deserve any money or shouldn't get any money, even though I pay a boatload of money over a long period of time, also as well as taxes. One thing I'm skeptical of is any organization, whether it be for right this matter, the Democratic Party or even AARP, that won't allow choice and discourages choice and obviously didn't come up with their own plans. Here's my question for your group, and I don't know it, but if let's say that they do index it, or let's say I get little or no benefits, or let's say they let me opt out of receiving Social Security. If I would agree with that, if they would cut my rate on taking money out of my separate IRA from, you know, whatever it is, 15, 20, 30%, and give me a fair tax break, I'd opt out of receiving Social Security money as long as they give me a better tax break on the money I receive on my investments. Would that work?
Bob Posen, isn't this a part of what concerns you, that when you start to move things around and say, you get this right, you get this right, you get this right, some people just say, you know what, I don't want to be a part of this anymore.
Yeah, I think that I'm trying to preserve the social insurance structure of the system, and I agree with the caller that if he pays in substantial amounts, he ought to get something back from Social Security. And if you don't give him something substantial back from Social Security, then he or she's gonna opt out totally. And I think that people who criticize progressive indexing to say, well, the high wage worker will get modestly more benefits, and we're worried that they'll oppose the system. They don't realize that if what happens is instead we get these big increases in payroll taxes and these 3% legacy taxes, then I think somebody like the caller is going to say, now let me understand this. You're worried about my political support for the system if 20 or 30 years from now I'm going to get slower growth and monthly benefits, but you're not worried if you increase the payroll taxes and add on to that another 3% legacy tax? I think that's a much more politically explosive approach.
John, are you still there?
Yeah, but my question is, I will continue to pay what I owe in Social Security with taxes. I'm not talking about opting out there. I'm talking opting out of receiving a benefit if you will give me a favorable tax on my SEP or my IRAs that I'm trying to stash money away, number one. That's my number question. And to me, why aren't the senior citizens, if they've been blatantly told that their Social Security benefits are not going to be affected, or let's say anybody over 55 years old, why are they rallying against something like this?
Jason, do you want to talk to John on that one?
Well, I hear senior citizens all the time. They're not selfish. They care about their children. They care about their grandchildren. And they understand firsthand how important Social Security is. I mean, one thing to understand, two-thirds of senior citizens get more than half of their retirement income from Social Security. So the bulk of retirees, this is the core program for them, and they understand that better than anyone.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Raleigh, North Carolina, Adrian's with us. Hi, Adrian.
Hi. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you for calling.
Great. I just wanted to call in and say give my support to progressive taxing. I'm 25 years old, and I think that Social Security will be insolvent coming in the relatively near future, and that if we don't put in some extra money into it, it is going to pay out smaller benefits to everybody. It will behoove everybody if we put in some extra money. We might feel the pinch if we don't have progressive taxing and progressive benefit decrease. So I think it will probably help everybody in the short run.
Can I ask you, Adrian, when you make this sort of commitment to this kind of progressive indexation, are you imagining yourself as someone who will be making $50,000 over your lifespan, or $100,000 a year over your lifespan? Where do you place yourself there?
I'm hoping to make somewhere between $70,000 and $90,000 a year.
And you don't have a reservation taking a look at a grid or a graph and saying that, you know, maybe by the time you retire, the benefits at that wage level might not be what they are under today's plan?
None at all. And in fact, I think it's a good thing. I think we should help people of lower income more than we do. I think it's a shame the people that put in a lot of hard work are retiring at a lower benefit than people that are retiring that put in hard work but don't put in manual labor and don't abuse their bodies so much.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Adrian, thanks for that. Bob, first to you on this.
Adrian, I appreciate your support for the proposal, and I think you make a very important point. It's easy, like the first caller, to say, well, I'm not happy with a 6% or a 10% decrease for my scheduled benefits. I'm a middle-income person, and I'd like to have as much benefit as possible. But if we don't do this sort of progressive indexing or some other major reform, then people are going to look at a 25%, a 27% cut in benefits. That's what automatically happens in 2040, 41 when the system defaults. So I think it's actually, as Adrian points it out, it's more humane to try to fix the system through these progressive benefits, protecting the low-wage worker, and making sure that the system's there for these young people in 30, 40, 50 years, than allowing the system to default. And to me, the biggest frustration is that with all this political stuff back and forth between Democrats and Republicans, nothing will get done, and that will really be the worst for the future generations.
I'm glad, in a way, that you brought it back to politics. We've got about 4 or 5 minutes left in the program, and I want to try and put it in that kind of light to look at it. And Jason, this brings back the point that you were making of saying it's really hard to talk about the indexing without speaking about private or personal accounts, because obviously that's going to be a part of the political equation. What I found interesting Thursday night, and you and I might quarrel about this, was watching the president look into the camera and say to people, you know, if you did have a personal account, you'd be able to pass it on to your kids. You'd be able to pass it on to your spouse. I'm thinking to myself, I wonder if he's going to make this case here, that it's not necessarily a negative when we look at it. What do you think?
Well, inheritance is probably one of the most misleading benefits that people tout for individual accounts.
Yeah.
Just two things that people should understand. If your spouse inherits your account, your spouse will also inherit all the benefit reductions you agreed to when you signed up for that account. In Bob's plan, when your children inherit your account, they take all the money you contributed to the account plus 3% interest out of it before giving it to your children. Often there'll be nothing left in the account after that process.
So simplify this for me, because I'm starting to get lost in numbers. It happens on radio.
The basic idea is, whenever you agree to an account, you also agree to a set of benefit reductions to repay the money in that account.
Right.
Whoever inherits that account is going to inherit all of those benefit reductions as well. So on net, they're not necessarily coming out ahead as a result of the account. They have a big pile of money, but they have an even lower Social Security benefit that their husband agreed to when their husband first set up the account. That's how the accounts work. They're considerably less attractive for inheritance than a lot of people think. Now, Social Security right now, though, has a great thing for inheritance. Their survivor's benefits pays, you know, 1/6 of Social Security goes to children under the age of 18 or spouses in order to help get them by year after year.
I want to come back on this with Bob Posen. The progressive indexing, I mean, I get from listening to this past hour, you know, is the stuff that people can have a reasonable debate over. But I'm wondering if Jason's got something in saying, once you put the personal private accounts into the mix, the teeter-totter tips, and that's the end of a conversation over indexing. What do you think?
Well, I've said often that the president needs to show flexibility on personal accounts. Jason is making some good points, quite good points, about what I call carve-out personal accounts. But there are add-on personal accounts. There are all sorts of ways in which you could do this. And I think the most unfortunate thing would be if all this heated debate on personal accounts prevents us from talking about solvency. We talked about solvency first. We had a good conversation. We reached an agreement and outlines. We would then need to have some sweetener in the political package to make this go through. And then we could talk about what sort of personal account, if any, would be appropriate, and we could sort of deal with these issues. But instead, we've gone about it backwards. We've been focusing on the personal account. People have great hostility, great feelings on either side about this. And to me, again, you go back, if we don't get to this solvency discussion, it's easy to say that the president didn't throw off personal accounts, but he did have some real political courage to say, I'm willing to talk about pain here, benefit changes in formula.
From a Democrat. Yeah. I mean, you're a registered Democrat.
In the past,
your party need to demonstrate that same kind of courage?
I think that both parties need to come up with, if the Democrats don't like personal accounts, that's okay. They don't like this form of carve-out account. Jason makes some good points. Then let them come up with some packages that start to deal with the president's proposal and sort of modify it and make it acceptable to them. That's what we need in the debate.
All right, thank you for coming in. It's been good to hear your proposal. Bob Posen is chairman of MFS Investment Management in Boston. And Jason Furman, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Jason, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington. Our program is produced by Sarah Baker, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts, with help from Patrick Kiker. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.